Everyone. This morning, I would like to talk pretty directly about the special practice that we're doing these days during the pandemic, when so much that we take for granted inside and outside the Zendo has stopped, and very many of us are staying in our houses all day long. Some of us are working, some of us not working at home, but most of us not going anywhere, not seeing people. I know it's a very big world and everybody's life is different, so maybe for some of you that I'm speaking to, it's not like that. So I guess mostly I'm talking about my own practice, how I've been practicing, and I think many of my friends, including many of you, probably practicing in similar ways. And basically, we're doing hermit practice, right? When they talk about monasticism, they categorize two kinds of monasticism, eremitic and cenobitic. The eremitic monastics mostly practice alone, and cenobitic monastics practice in community, like most Catholic orders of monastics, and most Zen monastics typically are cenobitic. But there is a tradition in Zen and Catholicism as well of eremitic monasticism. So that's what we are these days. We have been forced to become eremitic monastics. We're alone a lot more than we used to be. And even if you're like me and you live with someone else, still, we're living very quietly, more slowly than we used to be living. And our sitting every day is probably a little more quiet than it was because there's less stuff stirring around in our lives, so the mind is a little bit more quiet. And every day we're taking care of meals because we're not going out to eat, we're not eating on the run. We're taking care of meals, we're taking care of cleaning more than we used to. Daily living chores are more important now than they used to be. And this is such good Zen practice, to be quiet and to be mostly concerned about what is immediately in front of you in practical, physical, everyday ways. So we're all doing this. And at our house, every day, we never did this before, but every day we talk about what will we eat for this day? And we are managing, you know, the food in our kitchen and food coming in and using it up. We're cleaning up the floor. Big job, it turns out, cleaning up the sink, cleaning up the surfaces, taking care of the place. We are not getting into cars. We are not riding on airplanes. We are not making really complicated arrangements. So not spending time going anywhere else. We're always right here. And when you settle into hermit practice, I think you find a very large space inside your aloneness. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. And it can be unsettling at first. So I don't know, maybe I'm just talking about myself, maybe I'm just revealing my own craziness. But it seems to me that when you have a lot of time to be alone, something begins to happen that you did not expect. You begin to realize how confusing it is to be you. How much is going on, and how odd a lot of it is. The usual assumptions that you have always had, that you have taken completely for granted, are no longer quite in operation because the rest of the world that supported them has stopped. and stuff that is buried deep below the surface of your mind begins now to rise up, maybe in little chunks, bits, pieces. Maybe it doesn't make a lot of sense. In normal life, so-called normal life, this stuff doesn't come. And should it come once in a while, you don't really have time for it, so you ignore it. You get absorbed in your busyness and by your need to relate to many people and think of many things, so you almost don't even notice. But now that those things are no longer the case, this does come to mind. It does come to heart. And it can be a little disturbing and weird, but also it is truly a wonder. I don't think there's anything that you do about this. I don't think you're trying to figure it out. I think you just allow it. You just bear witness to it as you would bear witness to a flower or a volcano. You are beautiful. You are terrible. You are inexplicable. In other words, you're human. And this that I'm saying is not a thought, an idea. This is a daily experience that hermits have. Probably many of you, like me, have been using Zoom a lot, like we're using it today and yesterday. So, you know, at first it was very quiet, and little by little there's more Zoom. Not only now are all the things that I had scheduled and thought I had canceled now coming back on Zoom, but there's more things emerging since people don't have to ask me to fly to faraway places, and since many practice centers are having financial trouble and want to have, you know, extra events on Zoom, they're asking me to help them out, and wherever I can, I'm saying yes. So in fact, I'm actually doing more stuff than I was doing before on Zoom. But seeing people on Zoom, and like I say, on Zoom, I'm actually seeing more people than I was before, because attendance at things that I do is, you know, almost double in many cases, because people from far away can come. Seeing people on Zoom, as you no doubt have noticed, is not quite the same as seeing people in person. It's as if the people that I'm seeing on my screen, just like now I can see a row of you on my screen, you are actually, from my point of view, as I am from your point of view, imaginary beings. You are ideas in my mind, most of you, of beings that I know. So I have already known you face to face, and so when I see your little Hollywood Square, I have an idea of who it is that I know. And these images have the purpose for me of reminding me of the people that I know, and also reminding me of how much I care about all of them, all of you. So rather than feeling like I'm busy seeing a lot of people, I feel like I'm in my hermitage meditating on people I know for the purpose of increasing my love and compassion. Just as if literally I were a hermit without a screen, without Zoom, visualizing in my mind sentient beings, so that I could generate more compassion and loving kindness. In other words, I'm not so much being with people, and I think probably we're all in the same boat here today. We're not so much being with each other as we are being with each other in our hearts and in our minds. And I've heard many people say that they like Zoom a lot, that in some ways they appreciate people more on Zoom than they did in person. Actually, people are kind of, can be a pain in the butt in person, you know, right? But on Zoom, they're very nice. Everybody's very nice on Zoom. And this seems really true to me. So in other words, in our hermit practice with Zoom, we are generating a lot more love and compassion than we did before, because we've sort of eliminated all the conflict and trouble, and all we have is how much we appreciate one another. And this is really good. In fact, maybe some of you at Mountain Range should work on composing a verse that you would chant before you click on the link to open up Zoom, a verse that inclines the mind toward love and compassion that you're about to practice when you open Zoom, and how grateful you are that even though you're a hermit in your cave, it's really great to remember that there are other people on earth to accompany you on your journey. Because think about how impossibly sad it would be if you were the only one, or you two were the only two. That would be, you couldn't even imagine, right? What a blessing that there are others. Well, despite our hermit life, we're all also, I'm sure, paying attention to the news. And I don't know what the news is saying in Canada, but here in the United States, the news is almost entirely about the pandemic. And there's so many things to be understood about it, so many angles. Its implications are all over the place. And it's everywhere. It's all around the world. So we have a sense when we participate in the news that all around the world, we are together in this, everywhere. Together in the fear, in the sorrow, in the grief. And there seems to be an almost universal upwelling of gratefulness for what we are now calling frontline workers. It means the doctors, the nurses, the hospital support staff, the first responders, but it also means the people who must risk their lives to keep going to work so that the rest of us can survive every day. Truck drivers, garbage collectors, grocery store workers, farmers, caregivers for children and the elderly, and all kinds of other people. And around the world now, in many places, there's a daily gratitude moment when we thank these people. I think it started in Italy when people applauded on their apartment balconies every evening. And then maybe they're still doing that. I know in New York, they're banging on pots and pans every day at a certain time of day as a sign of gratitude. And here, where we live, we howl like coyotes every day at 8 p.m. And that means we're grateful for all the people who are taking care of us. And my wife, Kathy, is tremendously devoted to this practice. And she's an excellent howler. She goes out there every night at 8 a.m. and we can hear all the other neighbors howling like coyotes. Because there's coyotes around here, quite a few of them. We see them a lot. And to me, this is such an important thing. Because it means that we are collectively, all over the world, developing a new vision of the dignity and importance of such workers and of all work. You know, in recent years, work has been becoming more and more of an abstraction. And without noticing it, it's become a really big problem. Instead of work being honored as work, work has become symbolic. Because it's not the work that matters. It's how much money the work generates, how much prestige the work generates, how much knowledge or power it advances. That is what work has become. And in Zen practice, we deeply value work as work. We understand work as the practice of prajna dana paramita, generosity. Dogen writes in the Four Methods of Guidance of a Bodhisattva, he says, to build a boat or a bridge is the practice of dana paramita. To produce things and earn a living is the practice of dana paramita. And now we really are getting to see how this is so. These frontline workers, these people who get up and go out every day and do an honest day's work, they really are generous. They're risking themselves for us. And we really do depend on them. They really are working on our behalf. And they know it. They're not working only for the money. And they have a great spirit and a great dedication that we're all admiring now. So maybe this is causing us to develop, finally now, in this so-called 21st century, a collective sense of a moral imperative that we should be grateful to these workers, to all workers. We should honor them, and we should make sure that all of them, all of us, one way or the other, will always be able to live, will always be able to have some income, some food, some health care, some housing, some education for our children. Maybe now it becomes clear to us that these things are basic compassion that we provide them for all of us, basic caring and basic justice. This pandemic will be over at some point, at least it will be over for a while. But as soon as it is over, many other serious problems will immediately reveal themselves. Big economic problems, big social problems, and especially really big environmental problems. So really, we're living in quite dramatic times when it's very likely that a great social reorganization is at hand. And in order for these big things that have to happen, we will have to have developed among us a sense of gratitude and compassion for one another, as well as some practical sense that people's survival can at least be minimally assured so that we can do what needs to be done for our collective future without harming people's livelihoods, especially those of the most vulnerable among us. And this pandemic, I think, is bringing us collectively, all of us, to that realization. Hermits float through their days. There's no time. Time just floats back and forth. A few days ago, when I was doing whatever it was I was doing, a thought came into my mind about this retreat. And I vaguely remembered that there was an email from Kate and Michael where we were agreeing that yes, let's do the retreat after all on Zoom. We won't cancel, we'll do it on Zoom. And then I thought, is that right? Was there really an email like that? Or did I just dream that? And I thought, I'm not sure whether I dreamed it or not. But anyway, I'm not sure anymore whether my dreams are more real or as real as anything else these days. But then I thought, well, even if there were such an email, the retreat isn't until May, and it's March. But then I thought, wait, it's not March. It's almost the end of April. And May is in a couple days. It's a few days from now. This retreat, if we're really doing it, it's like in a couple of days. So then I emailed Kate and Michael, and they said, oh yeah, we were just about to email you. Yeah, the retreat is in a couple of days. There's no time. Yesterday I was talking about a Book of Record 6, Yunmun's Every Day is a Good Day. Suzuki Roshi has a comment on this case, which is just a couple of sentences long. Here's what he says. Today does not become yesterday. And Dogen Zenji states that today does not become tomorrow. Each day is its own past and future and has its own absolute value. And he's referring, of course, to Dogen's famous essay on time, Uji, the time being, in which Dogen says more or less just this. He says, all of time is on each moment of time. On each moment of time, we pierce the veil of time and glimpse eternity. The conventional story of our life progresses from 1 minute to the next in a smooth, reasonable, biographical narrative from beginning to end. But that's just one way to see our lives. And as we know, it is a way full of many joys and also many sorrows. But mostly, it's a tragedy, because all too soon it comes to its end. But at the same time that story is going on, there is another story, a story of endlessness and non-conceptuality. For Dogen, for Zen, the essence of what the Buddha taught is non-self and impermanence, the emptiness of all dharmas, and the emptiness of time and space. And in their daily lives, hermits come to appreciate this, and they can feel it in the very texture of their daily living. They are called to eternal life by a flower, by a sensation in the body, by a thought in the mind, by the moon in the night sky, or maybe even by a face on the screen on Zoom, that pierces through the illusion of their life and brings them to the truth. Based on this truth, they commit themselves to a life of practice, a life of generosity and of simple caring for each and everything. Hermits come to value silence. They know that in the silence, they will always return to the human question. What is the most important thing? How do I live? Hermits don't need to know a lot. They don't need to have a lot. They don't need to be a lot. Because they understand that their life, and all lives have, as Suzuki Roshi often said, absolute value. They do not need justification. And hermits are very happy to live a life of floating questions, to live lives that are simple, elementary, basic. Well, I keep on writing stuff. This is my failing. I can't help it. So during these days, I just finished, I think, a draft of a very long poem, about 130 pages long, you know, about all this and the pandemic and everything, pondering how this little virus is doing all this. How does it work? And what about all the other times in the past we've experienced pandemics? Since at least Roman times, there have been big pandemics. We have the illusion, you know, that life goes on normally, but actually there's never really been a time when life goes on normally, on and on and on, for a little while, but then something always happens. Even in one short human lifetime, we see this. But, you know, there are many, many generations. And then there's the time on Earth before there were even humans. There has not been much normalcy. There has been enormous, huge changes in the Earth's climate. The Earth has been drastically reorganized many, many times. Meteor collisions, volcanic eruptions, and many pandemics that totally stopped the human world for decades before they went away and then came back. But life always goes on because this is what life has to do. Life seeks to make more life. Life wants to live today, and it wants to go on living tomorrow. And this is what this little virus does. It wants to live and to reproduce and to go on. It doesn't have any other big ideas. It isn't trying to hurt anyone. It isn't trying to do anything, make anything. It doesn't try to mean anything. It just wants to go on. And in this, it is exactly like you and I. This virus is our own greed, hate, and delusion. In other words, our own life force moving forward into the world. And we have to understand it and accept it. And of course, mightily exert our own desire to live and not die, to go on and not perish from the face of the earth, so that we can subdue the virus and go on living normally for a little while. When people first heard about Darwin's truly brilliant idea of evolution, they saw it as evidence of the universal struggle in nature that they already believed in. As they said, nature red in tooth and claw, which is a line from a Tennyson poem, and using a phrase that was already in use at the time, in the mid-19th century, nature red in tooth and claw. But now we know a lot more. So much more, exponentially more information about evolution. And we see that the ongoing movement of life is not so much a struggle as something awesome and beautiful, and we could even say loving. Although yes, for sure, it takes the form of life and death and life and death and life and death all the time. And this is the beauty and the tragedy of life, that it arises and that it passes away, just as the Buddha emphasized. If we insist that it be otherwise, we will have a hard time. But if we embrace it and see ourselves as not just this one body and mind, not just this one life, then we can have a deep and profound happiness, suffused with lots of gratitude, lots of love. So this long poem that I mentioned is, I had the idea long ago to write a poem that is mostly quotations from other things. So this poem has a lot of quotations from other things. Often I rewrite the other things I'm quoting. And I'm going to read for you just a short part of the poem, which is based on a quotation from Montaigne, 16th century French essayist Montaigne. Here's the excerpt. Unmoved, Samonidas, king of Egypt, saw his own daughter, a prisoner, pass by him captive in chains, and his son marched to his execution. But when his servant passed, dragged away among the many captives, he fell to weeping and tearing his hair and other extravagances of extreme feeling, because the former griefs were too strong for expression, whereas the latter burst the heart's dam, her waters poured forth. Some misfortunes are greater than we can bear, bringing melancholic, dumb, and deaf stupefaction, which benumbs the faculties. The violence and devastation of an excessive grief must of necessity astonish the soul and wholly deprive her of her ordinary function till she is able to vent herself in tears and lamentations that free her of the sudden oppression and give her room to work through at greater liberty a passage opened by grief for utterance. The painter of the sacrifice of Iphigenia drew grief on the faces of others, but when it came to the father, depicted a veil on his face, for no countenance was capable of expressing such sorrow. The miserable mother Niobe, having lost first 7 sons, then 7 daughters, was transformed into a rock. The German king Raisiac observed a fallen warrior, and when the armor was removed, knew him to be his own son, and without uttering a word, stood fixedly contemplating the body till the vehemence of sorrow overcame his vital spirits, and he sank down stone dead to the ground. For love, at its limit, deprives us of our faculties, paralyzes us when it is too strongly activated. Our tongue becomes torpid, our veins kindle with flame, our ears tingle with deafness, darkness veils our eyes. We are cast out of the world of our mind. When we love at high pitch, in full fit of fury, we swoon. Our soul so burdened with searing feeling that vitality withdraws from the body, leaving it dejected and languishing, and life is stopped in its forward motion for excess of love. So that love that's felt and expressed must be moderate. Light grief can speak. Deep sorrows are dumb. So this sense of a grief we carry that is so deep we can't even feel it, much less express it. A grief matched in equal measure by our love is something that hermits instinctively feel as they move slowly through their days. And although it may sound drastic here, grief is really a good thing. It's a healthy thing. I don't mean, you know, getting stuck in grief and falling down dead, but evoking grief as a daily practice to remember that every day on earth, during these times, and all the times in the past, and going forward into the future, as long as the future lasts, every day there is death, there is sorrow. In these days, this is a climate that we cannot avoid. It's all around us. We're hearing about it all the time. Even if we avoid the news, we know it's there. It's conscious and it's unconscious. So it's good to feel it. And I've been practicing myself every day, praying for every day, praying for all of us who are suffering from this virus, praying for our well-being, praying for those who have died, that their death not be painful and difficult, and for those who are close to death, that they will recover, that they will get well, and for all the workers, healthcare people who are caring for them and everyone supporting our lives, and all the suffering beings everywhere on earth, may all be well and may all know the conditions for peace, happiness, and well-being. And I just do this every day. And in this way, I make space in my life to remember that there is suffering, and there always has been, there always will be, in this time and in all other times. And now we really remember. So we need to practice grieving so that we can be strong and loving, so that we don't forget what this life is and has always been, and so that we can really be of benefit to others. So, thank you all for listening to my talk. I really appreciate it. I wouldn't have said all those things if you weren't here to listen. Thank you to Kate and Michael and all the other leaders of Mountain Rain. And thank you to all of you for supporting Mountain Rain. I am really and truly so moved by this community, our community, by all that you have done and built here, and what you offer to the world. What a wonderful Sangha. So many serious and committed practitioners. I don't know for sure, but I think the Buddha would be very happy with our Zoom retreat this weekend. So, thank you, and please sit with ease for the rest of our retreat until the end.
Do the chant to close the Dharma talk now?
May our intention equally extend.